Hey, everyone, you got a beer? Everybody got a beer? I've got my beer. I don't think I can make some of these discussions without a beer sometimes because they just are so out of hand. And I don't think anything has gotten more out of hand than this discussion about Obamacare. I have been spending a lot of time watching news reports, reading newspapers, magazine articles, looking up everything I can about Obamacare. And I got to tell you, I'm pretty certain most of you know more than what I do because I cannot figure this crap out. It's kind of disgusting, really. So we're going to try to filter out some of the politics and some of the disinformation and some of the misinformation tonight and actually get to some real answers about what is this, how's it going to affect my life, is it going to be good for me or bad for me? We've got a good panel of experts here. First, I want to introduce Paul Brand. By the way, Paul and I at different times worked in the same city, Rockford, Illinois, many, many years ago for me. And I have to tell you, I think you might agree, Rockford, Michigan's prettier. Paul Brand is Executive Vice President of Alliance for Health. They spend a lot of time trying to figure out how we can get healthcare costs down. Don Hazard is next to him. He's the Executive Director of Michigan's Consumers for Healthcare. You might have heard about these navigators who are supposed to help us get through this process and get signed up for the Affordable Care Act. He's the guy running all those navigators. And then on the end is Jake Neer. Jake is a friend of mine. He's also the Capitol reporter with Michigan Public Radio Network. Anybody here know Rick Pluta? Yeah, he has to work with Rick every day. So, yeah, poor guy. So we're going to start out really simply. I'm going to give each of you, I'm just going to give Paul and Don, because we know what you do. We're going to give Paul and Don a chance to just tell us for a minute what it is they do, what their role is in healthcare and healthcare cost insurance. And Paul, let's start with you. Give us a minute on what your goal is of your organization, Alliance for Health.
The Alliance for Health is a 65-year-old health advocacy organization in West Michigan. We cover Ludington down the lakeshore, over to Hastings and Ionia. Our job is to make sure that we get the highest quality, highest value healthcare delivered in West Michigan, accessible to everybody. It's a little job. So, obviously, the Accountable Care Act is of strong interest to our organization. It's the biggest change in our 65-year history of health advocacy in West Michigan. So, I'm clearly not the smartest guy in the room. Jake is. But I look forward to the discourse here today. I want to thank Michigan Radio for making this possible in my hometown of Rockford. It's in the tradition of fine public house political discourse in the United States of America, and it's great to have it right here. I also appreciate the great sensitivity shown by Michigan Radio in holding this on a travel day in the World Series. So thank you guys very much.
Being a St. Louis Cardinals fan, I almost insisted. So, Don?
My name is Don Hazard. I'm with Michigan Consumers for Healthcare. We are a statewide advocacy organization that represents healthcare consumers in Michigan. And we were actually created in response to the passage of the Affordable Care Act. We've been at this a long time. It's been over 100 years, really, since Teddy Roosevelt was running for president of the United States, advocating for some kind of a national healthcare policy. So after the Affordable Care Act was passed, the foundation community and the nonprofit community got together and said, look, we really need to make sure there's a consumer voice through this whole implementation process. So we try to represent consumer interests before policymakers, and also we do public education. In addition to that, we also are using this vast network that we put together to do that type of work to also make navigators available to individuals. So if someone in this community needs assistance in getting someone, getting themselves or someone in their family enrolled in coverage, we have navigators throughout the state to assist you at no cost.
Okay, let's go to the news now. Today, CBS News reported that in Michigan, 140,000 people are getting notices that they're being canceled by their insurance companies. The idea is that these plans that they've been buying for the last several years don't meet the minimum of the Affordable Care Act. They need to be a better policy. People are scared and they're outraged. How many of you buy your own insurance and have received a notice that you are going to lose your insurance? Got a few in here. So what's this going to mean? Don, let's start with you. we're getting these notices. It's scary. You've been seeing your premiums go up and your coverage go down for a while anyway. And now you're faced with this losing it, and you've got to go to this Obamacare, and we don't even know what the heck Obamacare is yet.
Well, it is scary. I'll concede that point. But we need to keep in mind that premiums have been going up 15 times faster than our household incomes over the previous decade. So something needed to be done. So what's happening is essentially we've created this baseline of benefits that every insurance plan in Michigan or in America has to cover. It's called the Essential Health Benefit. And it's basically it's a baseline of coverage that everybody has to offer in every policy. Well, a lot of policies can't meet that baseline. So the insurance companies have to decide, am I just going to cancel that policy and create a new one, or am I going to make adjustments to existing policies? So that's the process we're going through. And that can seem kind of scary if you get a notice in the mail saying your policy has been canceled. But the point is, it's to empower you as a consumer, okay? And the way that works is, it means now, for the first time, you know as a consumer, doesn't matter what plan you pick, any plan you pick, whether it's on the exchange, outside the exchange, is going to have this baseline of coverage. So that gives you, for the first time, the power of knowing one plan is clearly overpriced versus another plan, right? If you know that all the bronze plans, for example, on the marketplace cover essentially the same baseline of coverage, it's very clear to you to determine who's overpriced, and that gives you power as a consumer, and that's put pressure on the insurance companies to lower their rates.
Don, let me stop you there, because we've seen some states are only going to have one carrier, one provider for insurance. How many will Michigan have? What kind of choices are we going to have? And are we going to have platinum plans, which some insurance carriers are not offering because they're afraid people with pre-existing conditions or high need levels will sign up for those because they're cheaper? So give me an idea. How many carriers, and are we going to get all the levels?
We have tremendous competition in Michigan, and we're fortunate in that regard, in our individual insurance market. We have 13 different insurance companies, and they're offering an average on the marketplace of 43 different plans. So when you go to the marketplace, healthcare.gov, when they get it working, get all the bugs fixed, you go to the marketplace, you're going to have an average of 43 different plans to choose from offered by 13 different insurance companies. That's tremendous competition in comparison to what other states are experiencing. One New England state has one insurance company. That's it. That's not competition. So what makes it work, again, is that apples-to-apples comparison between plan where you can figure out that plan is overpriced. And if you take a look at some of the rates, some of these plans stick out like a sore thumb where they're $200, $300 per month more expensive than the other plans. That's going to put tremendous pressure on those insurance companies next year to reduce those rates to be competitive.
Paul, I want to talk to you. We've been talking about, you know, better coverage. Everybody needs coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Obamacare will help us get there. And it's a response to the fact that healthcare costs and insurance premiums have been going up. But it seems like we're trying to approach and treat the symptom rather than approach and treat the cause. What's causing healthcare costs to go up? Why are we in this predicament to begin with?
How much time do we have?
I'm giving you 2 minutes.
The first thing I want to say is if you've gotten a notice that you've lost your insurance coverage, it's important to understand that the minimum qualifying benefit, you know, we have the Olympic medals of healthcare coverage now, right? Bronze, silver, gold. It means that your coverage didn't meet bronze level in the exchange under the law, that you have less than bronze level coverage, and you're required to have bronze level coverage by the law. That's what it meant. Now, what does bronze level coverage mean? It means it has a 60% actuarial value. Am I talking in?
I have no idea what that means.
Actuarial, right? It means that the plan covers 60% of your risk and you cover 40%. That's what 60% actuarial value means, okay? So you're exposed to 40% of the risk, the plan's exposed to 60% of the risk. Is that good coverage? No, okay? No, it's minimal coverage according to the law, right? So if your coverage was canceled, you don't have 60% equivalent coverage. Everybody get that? That's been sensationalized over the last couple of days, but that's actually what it means. Okay?
So all these levels, all these cancellations are going out to people who have coverage that doesn't even meet the bronze level.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, let's talk about platinum coverage, right? I was just talking with large West Michigan employer whose name you know. They make office furniture.
Can you give us another clue?
There are actually several of them. And their corporate strategy is to be sure that their self-funded employee benefits, which are not on the exchange, are the equivalent of silver coverage. So large employers are moving towards silver coverage, which is 80% actuarial value, which means the employer is going to cover 80% of the cost, and you're going to cover 20. That's good coverage by great employers in West Michigan. Does that give everybody some perspective in terms of where we're at on the exchange?
Okay, let's go back to my question, though, about why have healthcare costs gone up so much that we have to make sure that everybody has mandatory insurance coverage so that we can... How's that going to limit healthcare costs going up?
Lester, I'm trying to dodge this question. Would you ask Jake? It's a two-part answer. The first part answer is the healthcare system is not a system. It's ramshackle. It's cottage industry. It's extremely inefficient in what it does. There are other cost drivers. It's highly technologically driven. It's highly labor-driven. That labor is expensive. Do you want the lowest cost nurse? You want the lowest cost doctor? Hey, the labor that's involved is very expensive, and the industry is very labor intensive. It's very technology driven. The technology tends to be very expensive. The bottom line is every time we measure how efficient healthcare is at what it does, it's about 20 to 30% inefficient. That means 20 cents or 30 cents on the dollar gets flushed. We're running scrap at that level. How many of you are in a business where you could afford to flush 30%? Nobody? Really? Nobody? So why do we put up with it in healthcare, ladies and gentlemen? But that's not the problem. As big as that is, that's not the problem. 20% of $3 trillion just getting flushed is not the problem. The problem is we are getting sicker year to year to year. That's
yeah,
the problem.
I saw a report today that said U.S. citizens are the worst out of 17 countries. We have the worst health out of 17 countries. And I thought, how can that be? It's not like we're Canada or England and have socialized medicine. We've got this great system.
Right.
We should be healthy.
There are a lot of social determinants of health status. In fact, the greatest predictor of your health status is what?
You drink more beer.
That's a second,
okay.
Lester.
Your zip code?
Your zip code. That's exactly right. Where you live has a great amount to do with how healthy you are. As powerful as those social determinants are, it's what we consume as consumers that determines what our ultimate health status is, how long and how well we live. It's what we put in our mouths and swallow. And the science of this is settled. If you eat the average American diet, you will get sick and die before your time. And that is what's driving our healthcare costs in the United States, and we've got to fix it. Next question.
Yeah, let's talk about what's going on the website issue. I mean, I don't expect that any of you is going to have a great insight to what's happening. But, you know, it kind of reminds me, have you ever seen a government roll out a program where there weren't some kind of glitches or a lot of political shouting and yelling? I mean, I'm a bit of a history buff, and I kept thinking, wow, I've read about when they rolled out Social Security and how the president was a socialist, and it just kind of echoed a little bit. I thought, maybe this has happened more recently, and then somebody was talking about Medicare Part D recently, about the expansion to prescription drugs, and you know, the Democrats were attacking George W. Bush about that pretty loudly and saying, you know, what is this going on? It's just mishandled by the administration. So the question I'd like to know is, we've been hearing a lot, we've been seeing from both the mainstream media and the fringe media how horribly the Obama administration has handled this and rolled it out. When is this thing going to be up and working? Your best guess for when is this thing going to be up and working so regular folks can go on and get this over with in 15, 20 minutes and make their selections and go on. Do we know? Any guesses?
Well, it's hugely complicated, right? Because we're
interfacing, I wanted the simple answer.
We're interfacing all, well, we've never done this before. So we're interfacing all these different technologies. They have to pull data from all these different departments, federal agencies.
Yeah, because we've got to deal with the income, because that's going to be a credit, a tax credit.
Right, your immigration status, a whole host of things have to be pulled from various databases. So we knew this was going to be very complicated. This isn't a surprise to us. We had 3 years to get ready. Michigan could have had its own marketplace. We had that option. We chose not to. We decided to put our citizens in this national portal with the citizens of 36 other states and just kind of jam everybody through the same federal website. So we had the option to do our own. I wish I could say that was a panacea, but that's not either. For example, there's one New England state. They've been working on this for 3 years. The federal government gave them tons of money to do the development of their website, and they haven't been able to enroll a single person. And that's just because they haven't been able to work out the bugs. So whether you're stuck in a federal exchange or a state exchange, this is complicated technology, and then we just have to work out the bugs on it. The latest we've been hearing is it'll take probably till the latter part of November, latter part of next month, before they feel they can get all the bugs resolved. But at that point, enrollment should be a relatively quick process.
End of November.
End of next month, yeah, November. Yeah. So the average application is only 3 pages long. So once we get that technology down, the actual application process should move quite smoothly.
Jake, I want to talk to you about Michigan. We turned down the idea of doing our own website, doing our own exchange. We finally passed Medicaid expansion to fill that hole of people who wouldn't have been covered otherwise. But it's going to be delayed because it wasn't a vote called immediate effect. Tell us what's going on in Lansing and whether the folks there have finally said, all right, fine, let's just let it run, let's leave it alone, let's let them do what they can and let Congress fight it every step of the way instead of Lansing.
First of all, hi, everyone. I think what we're seeing now, I don't know how many of you have been following what's going on in Lansing already, but we've seen a lot of major issues come up in the last couple of years where there's – am I too close?
You're not close enough.
Okay. I should know this. I work in radio. where there's a lot of talking, it seems like there's interest in something. Roads is a good issue, funding roads right now, where everyone says that they want to get something done, and they just talk until a deadline passes. And in this case at first, we had the option to create our own state exchange, and it seemed like there was interest in, you know, there was a lot of people that said, of course, we want local control. We want to have our own destiny. But, of course, anytime you mention Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, you don't want to be seen, especially as a Republican, someone on the right, as supporting it in any way, shape, or form. So it's become such a toxic issue that the state exchange just never happened. Deadlines passed. They didn't get anything done. And then the second option was to do a federal partnership. And this is something that the governor actually wanted himself. He said that this is something that we should do. He pursued it actively, saying that the state should partner with the federal government to create a state-federal exchange. And same thing happened where it did seem like there were even Republicans that said, well, you know, this is a good idea. We can at least get some local control here. And the deadlines passed and never got it done. So at this point, you know, when it comes to the exchange, you know, there is a possibility of setting up a state exchange or one of these other options for next year. But, you know, when it comes to the rollout, you know, Michigan residents have to rely on the healthcare.gov, which, as we've heard, is not gone so well.
So let's talk about Medicaid expansion briefly. The governor wanted it. Governor Snyder, a Republican, he got it from both houses, but it was a big, big, big fight among the Republicans. And then the Senate, to make it effective by the deadline, January 1, would have had to pass it with immediate effect. And they chose not to do that. So now what happens?
What happens now is that immediate effect is a procedural vote, which basically the state constitution says that a law automatically goes into effect 90 days after what's called sine die, which is just kind of when the governor, you know, says this legislative session for the year is over, and then 90 days from now, all the bills passed will go into effect. Most, it seems like most bills that pass, at least on this magnitude, the legislature goes around that. They say this is something that's important to get to implement right now, to put into effect right now. And so they do these procedural votes, which have been kind of controversial lately. We won't get into that, but called immediate effect. I don't know if I should go all the way back to the beginning here, but at least the House passed.
Why don't you give us a date when it will go into effect?
We don't know the exact date at this point. It depends on that signee die, the day where the governor says, you know, this is the end of the legislative session. But what we're looking at right now is probably March, probably mid-March, possibly early April. But, again, we're looking sometime around mid-March, unless these guys have heard something different.
Yeah, let's before we start talking about this any further, I want to make sure we understand what we're talking about here. This Medicaid expansion would allow Medicaid coverage for people up to 133% of poverty. Is that correct? Okay, and so without this going to effect, those people who are on Medicaid will still be on Medicaid. Those people who can go, sign up for Obamacare by January 1 can, and then there's going to be a hole, right? Okay, explain that.
Right, so the Affordable Care Act makes purchasing insurance more affordable. How do they do that? They do that by providing some type of assistance to everyone below 400% of the federal poverty limit. You're going to receive some type of assistance, whether that's tax credit or whether you're going to be part of that expanded Medicaid population we're talking about right now. So if you're above 133% but below 400%, you're going to get tax credits to make purchasing your insurance more affordable, a monthly reduction in your premium costs. If you're below 133%, you're that expanded Medicaid population. The problem is when they passed that law, Congress assumed all 50 states would go along with it, but the Supreme Court struck that down and then made it optional for every state to decide for itself what it wanted to do. So for those states that didn't go with the Medicaid expansion, everyone below 100% of the federal poverty limit gets nothing, basically. They get no tax credits. They get nothing. Fortunately, Michigan isn't going to be one of those states. Our legislature finally did do the Medicaid expansion. That means as of April 1st, that's the expected start date for this, as of April 1st, everyone below 133% of the federal poverty limit will be automatically eligible for this expanded Medicaid program.
It's important to understand who we're talking about here with Medicaid expansion. I mean, I don't really know what your politics are. Another beer, I won't know what my politics are.
We have another beer.
400,000 people in the state of Michigan fall between 100% of federal poverty level and 133%, of whom I'm told 330,000 of them are children, working poor, these people have jobs and go to work every day, or the mentally ill and disabled. Those people will suddenly have and be eligible for Medicaid and have health insurance and not have to go to the ER to get their health care. Okay? Today, when they go to the ER to get their health care, do they get turned away? No, because there's a federal law that says a hospital can't turn them away. Any of you been to an ER lately? Any of you walk out of there without having spent several thousand dollars? Is it the most cost-effective place to get your health care? No, it isn't. It's the worst place to get your health care if it can be delivered someplace else. But this is the only place available to these 400,000 people today. And when they go to the ER to get their health care, they get served, and they don't pay their bill because they don't have the money to pay for those thousands of dollars. Who pays their bill? You do, okay? So please understand that this Medicaid expansion, which the federal government, which is whom? Us, pays the bill, right? But we pay it equitably. We pay it not through a unlegislated tax that the hospitals place on employers and the rest of us who pay the bill, okay? It's an open tax that we all have something to say about.
I'd like to jump in really quick because there's kind of a twist in the expected start date for the Medicaid population in some ways. When the state legislature passed this bill to expand Medicaid, it wasn't just a straight expansion of Medicaid. There are a lot of other things connected to it. For instance, if you're part of the expected Medicaid population, the expanded population, and you're an able-bodied adult, You are expected. There's incentives, I guess, for people to stay healthy, to work with their physician, to set goals and to meet those goals. And if you do, your premiums can go down, and the amount that you pay toward your healthcare can go down. And there are other things that are in there as well that we have to get approved by the federal government, because we wanted to go our own route with this. We didn't want to just accept it as it was offered. And so what we need to do is we need to put in something called a waiver to the federal government, which is basically us asking them to approve our program. And so that's the process that's going on right now. The Department of Community Health, Michigan Department of Community Health, wanted to start signing people up for Medicaid early enrollment on October 1st. But because the legislative process went so long, it took the legislature so long for them to pass the Medicaid expansion, they were not able to do that. In fact, they haven't even submitted the waiver request yet. They're still working on it. They've been visiting Washington, D.C. to meet with the Obama administration to see how they're doing with, drafting this and so forth. So far, they're hoping to submit the waiver by the end of November. And if they do, I believe the process to get those approved is something like 90 days. That's the expected. And if that's true, then yes, there's a possibility that this will start on October or on April 1st or even mid-March, possibly. So it really depends on whether or not the Obama administration actually approves our program.
You know, I listen to these stories. I hear these guys. I hear what they're saying. I hear what all the reporters at Michigan Radio are saying, all the other things. I just can't understand how both state government and federal government can mess up things faster and more intensely than they have with this program. It's pretty interesting, and I can't decide. And part of the problem is the media reports on this have just been horrendous. I mean, I don't know what to believe, and I'm in the business. And
thanks, Lester.
Yeah. All right, I want to talk about one thing. There's been a lot of talk about, but the Republicans have been asking the Obama administration, look, you let business delay the implementation of this for a year. Obviously, you're not ready because the computer website is all messed up and you guys don't know what you're doing. And so why don't the people get a delay? And I keep looking at this and I'm thinking, basically, you can delay it. It costs you $95 or 1% of your taxable income. If you want to take a pass on this until it settles out, that's pretty cheap, I think, to do that. I mean, not that you should have to pay anything, but, the Supreme Court said this is a tax and you will pay it if the administration wants you to. And that's where we're at. So, does it make sense to delay for a year? Maybe I'm 27 and I feel invincible. God, I wish I were 27 again. And I feel invincible and I'm not going to get hurt and I haven't been buying insurance anyway and I'm not going to buy it now because that's money out of my pocket I can't afford. So I'm going to take the $95 hit and go on with it. What's your response to that? While you do that, I'm going to go get a beer.
$95 is not going to force anyone to buy insurance. I mean, we can all do the math, right? We know that if I buy a private insurance policy, I could be spending anywhere from $500 to several thousand dollars a year for that insurance policy. So a $95 fine isn't going to get you to purchase that insurance. What's going to get you to purchase that insurance is purchasing insurance more affordable. Really, that is what's going to sell the Affordable Care Act. When people understand how these tax credits work, how they're applied to your monthly premium, the drive-down costs, that anyone under 400% of the federal poverty limit receives assistance. For a family of four, that's an adjusted gross income of $94,200. So a family of four, before it's adjusted, that's a six-figure income, and you're still receiving federal assistance to purchase insurance. So that's a lot of assistance being made available to you. For example, a family of four with an income of $50,000 can buy a plan for $80 a month. So less than your cell phone bill, probably, that cell phone in your pocket, less than what you're paying monthly for that cell phone in your pocket, you could provide health care coverage for a family of four. So that's the sort of thing that's going to get people to go to the marketplace and purchase insurance. It's not going to be a $95 fine.
All right. We were going to go 45 minutes on this, but I got to tell you, I want Jake to address. We got a question from the bar. I'm not sure I understand the what the answer might be, but I'm going to let you ask and answer that question if you can. And then we're going to open it up to you folks, because I got a feeling you've got a lot more personal experience with this whole situation than I do.
So, Jake, keep the bartender happy, buddy.
It's not the bartender. It's
that's what I'm worried about. So this the question is, what changes did Michigan ask for in Medicare? Did you mean Medicaid? Okay, Medicaid. For one thing, and I don't want to bore everyone with all the details here going back to the beginning, but when this was first, we'd been talking about expanding Medicare in the legislature, or Medicaid, you did it to me, you messed me up, in the legislature for months before a bill was actually introduced. When a bill was actually introduced in the House by the Republican leadership there, the reporter's reaction was sort of, okay, this isn't really a good starting point. It sounded like they were just offering something that it would never get passed and people wouldn't ever go along with. And some of the things that they wanted to do with Medicaid after 48 months, 4 years, they would kick people off the program if they were part of this expanded population, if they were an able-bodied adult. And the definition of able-bodied adult was sort of, still is a little bit murky, I think. But
so this is the same thing they're doing with welfare. You get 4 years and you're out.
Right.
4 years with Medicaid, you're out.
Exactly.
If you're able-bodied.
Yes. And so there were things like that in the bill that just seemed like they were poison pills, that the bill would just, be dead in the water at that point. A really, really remarkable thing happened, and negotiations started. Which was sort of strange with both parties, actually. But there was a little bipartisanship here. Go figure. But they dropped that 48-month cap in terms of actually kicking people off. Now what will happen is if you're part of that expanded population, if you after a while your premiums will go up after 48 months, and also copays, things, just your entire contribution to your healthcare will end up going up after 48 months. But other changes that they requested, again, they wanted healthier lifestyles for you. They wanted people to work with their physicians to, like I said, set goals and try to meet those goals so that premiums could go down. They call this the Healthy Michigan Plan, and basically the idea is they want to incentivize healthier behavior, and we've talked about that already. And that seems to be one of the goals of all this is, if we're going to drive down healthcare prices, we have to be healthier in the end. So, other changes, I think if you guys know, I think that they were a little more innocuous than those. But I think those were probably the two biggest ones that that we asked for in Michigan.
You have something?
Yeah, I want to go back, Lester, to your question about why not just delay this mess for a year. Seems reasonable, doesn't it? There's a deal that was done, and everybody needs to understand what the deal is that made healthcare reform possible. Anybody know what it is?
Get the younger people in so we can
today, if you have a significant health history, there's a really good chance that if you went to the private market and tried to buy health insurance, you couldn't get it. Right? You are uninsurable because no insurance company wants to assume the risk of your future health care expenses. Right? January 1st, everybody in the country is insurable. Right? In exchange for the health insurers of this country agreeing to that, they got something. And what they got was everybody's got to buy insurance. My market just got much bigger, right? And you know what they did? They gave the job to their who? Their actuaries. You like that word? That's my word of the day. Actuary. And they went and crunched the numbers and came back and said, you know what? We win. This is good for us, right? The health plans of this country love Obamacare, okay? This is a good deal for them if it works as written. But, slight hitch, they really had to turn their business model around 100% in order to get it done because they're used to selling to who? Healthy people who work for employers, right? That's how healthcare gets delivered in this country. So they're used to delivering healthcare through the employment vehicle. And so they sell business to business. They've got a business to business selling model, right? Are there businesses buying on the exchange? No. You buy on the exchange as an individual. This is a business to consumer business model. They've gone from wholesale to retail, and they've had to turn their business model on its head in 3 years. That is not cheap, ladies and gentlemen. They have spent millions and millions of dollars to do that, to get ready for these exchanges to open. Now, tell them you're going to delay it for a year. That's the problem. You're breaking the deal that we cut with the insurance companies to insure everybody. Okay? And that's why delaying it for a year is not going to happen.
All right, you all remember Steve? Steve's got a portable microphone. If you've got a question, raise your hand. He will take the microphone back, and we're going to start taking some questions here.
All right. And we're gonna ask you just state your name first and try to make your question brief.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and no political rants. We just don't have time for that.
Oorah.
Yep.
My name is Glenn Winters, and I'm from Three Rivers. And my question is, when you started talking about able-bodiedness and them, you know, trying to determine this, can you see, is there a provision in the act that would prevent them from using the medical knowledge gained from more people using doctors to determine this? Like if you're on the expanded Medicare, you know, are they going to be able to look in your medical records and say, yeah, you're able-bodied, go find a job?
Yeah, expanded Medicaid. Yeah.
My understanding is that particular issue is protected by another federal law called HIPAA, which grants privacy to your medical record. So even though your doctor can see it and your insurance company can see it, they can't use it for those kinds of determinations. That's per se illegal.
Question right here, Steve.
Hi, I have a question. I heard that the...
Name, please.
Linda,
where are you from?
Grand Rapids. Yeah. I understood that the Republican opposition to the Medicaid expansion was the limited federal funding, that the federal funding was going to expire. It was only good for short term. When that does expire, who's holding the bag?
That was never the case and was never true. So in the Affordable Care Act, the federal contribution to the expanded Medicaid program is 100% for the first 3 years, and then it steps down over time to 90%. So the lowest level it will ever get in the statute is 90%. So the opponents of doing the Medicaid expansion simply ignored what was written in the statute and just kept saying that the federal government will stop paying. But they would actually have to change the law for that bottom 90% to be changed.
I wanted to jump in really quick. There was actually one of the other major changes to the program that was put into the bill. Is sort of a I can't remember what the word that they said was, but it was like if the federal government does end up dropping below 100% actually of full funding, but the state isn't making that up in savings, the expanded population goes away. The expansion just goes away. So this, but the governor expects that that expanding Medicaid, that this program that was passed in the state legislature, will save us more money even than once the government, well, the federal government drops below 100% and goes down to 90%. So whatever the state ends up having to pay, the proponents of this bill say we're going to make that up and more in savings.
So the bottom line is the state's going to, no matter how you calculate it at this point, the state's going to save money on this. Even when we get down to 90% coverage by the federal government and still have to pay in, we're still going to save a lot more than that.
And in the meantime, the savings that we're getting before they're getting down, the state's actually going to be saving that money for later.
Free federal money, which is pretty good since Michigan is one of the lowest recipients of federal tax dollars in the nation on a per capita basis.
Well, we were projected to save $1 billion the first decade. So at $1.2 billion, I think House Fiscal said.
In Michigan.
Here in Michigan, yeah. So why are we saving that kind of money? Because the federal Medicaid program is going to be picking up expenses that the state is currently picking up. So someone else is paying the tab for providing the same services to some of our citizens. So there's huge savings involved. And when we were talking earlier, why did negotiations pick up? They picked up because people could do math and people could figure out, oh, my God, we can't let over $1 billion go.
That's news to me.
Some can do math.
Yeah. He's an accountant and a lawyer. He figured it out. Yeah, he can do math. We've got a
Dick Kamischke from Grand Haven. I hear on the television, radio, those people were speaking against Obamacare are using numbers like 40% higher in premiums as this goes through, and they're trying to scare, I believe, people from that this is a bad program. I don't expect prices or costs to stay level because they always go up. But what percentage of the premium cost should be going up because of Obamacare going in and replacing what we have?
You've asked the most important question so far, and the one I've asked a lot of experts, and that is, are we going to get better coverage? Is it going to cost less or more?
Yeah, well, we're going to get much better coverage. That got glossed over, I think, earlier in our conversation. But one of the reasons all these plans have to be canceled is they can't meet the quality standard. So over half the plans in this state don't cover maternity. Next year, every plan has to cover maternity.
So is my premium, like he said, going up 40%?
No. So they did calculations, and to pay for these expanded premiums, expanded programs, it'll probably increase your premiums about 1% to 3%. Anything above that is just the insurance company adding on, as the insurance companies always try to do to maximize profitability. What you have to keep in mind is what's happening is the law is also capping how much insurance companies can make in profits. So they can't make as much profit as they used to. Now they have to put more money back into your care. That's picking up a lot of the costs for these expanded programs.
This is something they suggested, the Democrats suggested in Michigan for auto insurance, I recall. I don't want to get off on the topic of auto insurance. I'll go on all night. But putting some restrictions on some of these profits, because Michigan insurance companies are some of the most wealthy insurance companies in the nation. Go ahead, Paul. You were about to make a real point, so.
I haven't been accused of that yet tonight. So, the law requires that for small group, the insurance company has 20% of the premium dollar to operate its function, pay claims, issue policies, all of that good stuff that they do customer service. On large group, they have 15% of premium to do that and generate their profit. And if they don't spend 80% of the dollars or 75% of the dollars on paying your health care costs, they owe you a refund. And, in fact, those refunds have been generated the last 2 years. So profits are absolutely capped. Insurance companies have an incentive to get as absolutely as efficient as they can.
You know, whether it's a Democratic issue or a Republican issue, whether it's a Democratic administration or a Republican administration, the opposing party is going to muddy up an administration's program as much as it possibly can, right? Well, I mean, we know that. It's simple Washington and sometimes Lansing politics. What makes this different, I think, is we've never seen the polar extremes of cable news like MSNBC and Fox News grab hold of this and produce so much misinformation, disinformation, and the talk radio shows have just been, it's incredible to hear some of the things you hear. And both sides, far left, far right, middle left, middle right, are all guilty of this. It seems like there's no body in the middle just trying to find out, okay, what is this really going to mean? It's already a law. We're not going to be able to repeal it. Let's not shut down the government. Let's just figure out what the heck it's going to do to my premiums, and am I going to be able to get the coverage I need and without going bankrupt? And almost nobody is answering that question, and you guys are working on it.
Other than NPR, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was going to jump in really quick. I thought this might be a good moment to bring this up based on what Lester said, and I apologize. I know we've got questions, but I'm sorry to get into politics of this too, but one of the most significant political moments of this entire process of getting the Medicaid expansion through the legislature, probably in my mind, was right before the State House passed the bill. And we had a Representative Mike Shirky speaking on behalf of, for the bill. If you know who Mike Shirky is, you'll know that he's one of the most conservative members of the state legislature, probably in the top three when it comes to most conservative people. He was a proponent of this bill, and what he said on the state floor was, Obamacare, in his words, is the law of the land. We need to stop playing defense on this bill and start playing offense. And on the state level, and Democrats will admit this, because they wanted to expand Medicaid as was offered by the Obama administration, that after all these negotiations with all the things that they put into the state's plan, this was better legislation than they would have pushed through the legislature, and that came through negotiations. And this was months before the government shut down, by the way. So we had, probably you could say Tea Party people in the state legislature who were saying, that we need to actually work with this instead of just trying to shut it down.
Yeah, Mike Shirky is he's from the Jackson area. He owns a manufacturing outfit. He's non-union. He was key, instrumental in getting right-to-work laws passed. So he's no blushing pilot. He's got solid conservative credentials, and he was on board. Steve, where'd you go? Who you got?
Hi, I'm Steve from Rockford. I work for a small employer in Grand Rapids, and I think our insurance premiums have gone up 25% every year since I've worked there. And near as I can tell from what I've been able to find on the website, it would be less expensive to go to the Affordable Care Act for insurance. If your employer offers insurance, can you opt out of it and get into that plan?
Well, it's a little bit complicated. First of all, your employer should go to the marketplace to look for coverage for you. So right now, a small employer with fewer than 25 employees could have the federal government picking up 50% of his or her costs, providing coverage to their employees. So if your employer is not going to the marketplace, they're potentially leaving a lot of money on the table. Now, in regards to you as that employee, you too can go to the marketplace and buy insurance if your employee is not providing you affordable coverage, right? The marketplace is for people who don't have coverage and for people who are not being provided affordable coverage by their employees. And that's defined as 9.5% of your salary. So if your employer is asking you to kick back over 9.5% of your salary, then you can go to the marketplace, you can purchase insurance, and you can access tax credits just like someone who doesn't have insurance.
And when you do that, that triggers a penalty for your employer, a tax penalty for that.
Only for large employers, not for small employers. There is no mandate at all on small employers.
All right.
Tom from Grand Rapids. A small business owners, less than 50 employees, do not required to provide insurance. What would you say is the most advantageous way for a small employer to offer the maximum health care insurance for an employee when you don't have to under the new CARE Act? I'm thinking more of the defined contribution model. So what would you advise a small business owner to do that really is not required to provide health insurance that would want to?
The defined contribution model is like 401ks for healthcare, right? So your employer makes a contribution to your retirement account, and you manage it. You decide how you're going to handle those investments. You decide when you're going to take distributions. All of that is up to you. The defined contribution applied to healthcare means your employer tells you the contribution they're going to make towards your purchase of your healthcare coverage. And that would allow you then to go out into the public exchange or many developing private exchanges and buy your own healthcare coverage. And I think last time, I'm newly back from the state of Illinois, but I can tell you in the state of Illinois, when we looked at the cost of small group coverage to employers versus buying individual coverage for their employees on the exchange, there was a 15 to 40% advantage in the individual marketplace. And that was before the public exchanges opened. So I think you're going to see that continue today. An advantage in the exchanges to the employer. Correct.
Hi, I'm Kevin from East Grand Rapids. Question about what about large employers? Companies like Walgreens, they're looking at putting 120,000 employees into the individual health insurance pool. How is that working as far as large employers versus small employers? Are they being incentivized to do that, and are their employees benefiting from this? And is that something that's going to be more of a trend for large employers?
We're running the experiment now, as you suggest. Most larger employers are self-funded. That is to say that they pay the claims for their employees and families' health care themselves, okay? They are not buying insurance. So they calculate their cost of coverage very carefully. They know what it costs them per employee and per family, and now they have a very convenient way to compare how their plan performs versus the public exchange. And so what you're seeing at Walgreens is they know how to do math, okay? And they've calculated that it's cheaper for them to put their people in the exchanges rather than continue to self-fund their own benefits. What you're going to see is, again, employers are going to standardize their benefit plans largely on what's available in the exchanges. So their plans are going to become silver, gold equivalents, right? So they're going to be able to go right to the exchange and price the same coverage in the exchange and know if they can do a better job delivering it for you or whether it would be better off for you and them to put you in the exchange. And we're running that experiment right now in the exchanges.
I'm Tom from East Grand Rapids. This is a little bigger picture thing. Let's say that you're a supporter of this. What are the 3, 4, maybe 5 things that really move us forward as a society in terms of the idea of covering everybody or, you know, moving forward in that sense? Long-term goal of progressives to try to cover everybody. So what are the 3, 4, 5 things that are really great about this? On the other hand, what are 3, 4, 5 things about this law that fall far short and would surprise and frustrate progressives?
And yeah, I think it's been described as a flawed piece of legislation. There's no doubt about that. So even if you're a really, really big fan of this, there are improvements to be made. So let's start with this question. 3, 4, 5 things that you think are really great about this, and everybody's going to cheer this 10 years down the road.
Okay, well, I'll just kick out an example of each. One thing I think that is really key about this is the fact that we're finally getting at the uncompensated care issue. We're finally getting at making sure everyone has coverage, has a physician, is under a physician's care, isn't using the hospital emergency room as their primary care physician. Why is that really important? I think that will put pressure on providers to reduce costs. And the question was earlier, why is it costing us so much? Well, it's because everything in America costs more in relation to healthcare. There's no comparing anything in America in comparison to the rest of the world as far as costs. And I think the uncompensated care issue has just been used as sort of this mirage or cover story to set any rate anybody wants to set. One woman was complaining to me that she was charged $35 for a maxi pad while in the hospital, right? It didn't cost the hospital that much to purchase that, okay? They're using uncompensated care as an excuse to just create incredible cost write-ups on everything. So we're finally dealing with the uncompensated care. That is going to imply pressure. That's good. But on the negative side, there's lots of aspects to the law that need work. For example, if an insurance company raises your rates over 10%, it has to go through rate review. That means we have to go through a process of determining whether that rate was justified or not. That sounds good, but what happens if they determine that rate is not justified? All that happens then is the insurance company someplace on their website has to bury somewhere on their website that it was found that their rates were not justified. But there's nothing in the law that actually makes them reduce their rates even after they find their rates are unjustified. They simply have to bury some message somewhere on their website. So there's lots of things that need to be worked on as far as the Health Care Act. But again, it gets at some really big issue problems in this country that I think over time are really going to help get costs under control.
Awesome. Well, we talked about the fact we've got a new social contract, right? And we do. And that is we are going to cover everybody, regardless of their health status. And we've all agreed to do that. That's the deal. In return, we all agree we're going to be covered. We're going to carry health insurance of one form or another. And it's available to us through Medicaid, through a system of private insurances with a system of subsidies and tax credits, or out of pocket ourselves if we don't qualify for any of those. That's the new deal. Okay, we have a new deal. Everybody understand it. That's what we've agreed to. Okay. What we have done there is agree to how we're going to finance the problem. Okay. What's the mechanism by which we're going to pay for these ever increasing healthcare costs? But we've not fixed the problem. Okay. healthcare costs are going to continue to increase on this very ugly, unaffordable trend that's going to break you, your family, this town, this state, and this country. And we don't delude yourself. We have not fixed the problem.
More questions.
My name is Greg. I'm a student at Grand Valley State in Grand Rapids. And a while ago, just before and right after the government shutdown took effect, there was a lot of talk about conservatives at the national level wanting to repeal a medical device tax, which is part of the law. And that was talked about a lot, but I never actually really heard what that tax is or what it does. Can you explain to all of us what the purpose of that is?
Yeah, I've only got the broadest of understanding of that. Do you know?
Well, you have to pay for the act, right? And people are under the impression that the Affordable Care Act is not paid for. That's not true. There are a whole host of tax increases in the Affordable Care Act that pay for the law. The Congressional Budget Office has looked at this, has confirmed and reaffirmed it's paid for. One of the funding mechanisms for the Affordable Care Act was a new tax on companies that make medical devices, medical device implants, that sort of thing. I believe it was about a 2.5% tax. There's been a move by these medical device companies to try to get that tax removed. If you actually look into it, it's really even the association that lobbies on behalf of these medical device companies cannot point to a single example of anyone losing their job because of the Affordable Care Act and this tax increase. So when you look at the tax write-offs involved and everything involved, it's a very nominal tax. It's a funding mechanism. It has no connection to people losing their jobs. And if we really want to open up that can of worms and start removing funding mechanisms for the Affordable Care Act, how are we going to replace that money?
Yeah, look, it's pretty clear among fiscal conservatives and many economists that any tax is going to be bad for corporation. And they're saying that, medical device manufacturers are people who need research and development dollars. They need to make sure if we do this, this could reduce the ability of these companies to do more R&D. It could reduce their ability to hire more people and produce the next miracle device for people to make their lives easier. But the fact is, we don't know what the impact is going to be. It's 2.5%. The Obama administration seems flexible on this, and it may be one of the first chips on the table from what I hear out of Washington. But anytime you hear tax and job killer, it's kind of basic economics, although not often proved to be the case. It's just like environmental regulation and job killer, which has again and again proven not to be the case. So I don't know if that gets to your point, but I'm always a little skeptical when I hear that, especially when, medical device makers in the U.S. are usually multi-billion dollar companies.
Medical devices are really high margin, really high margin. They make a lot of money per item. So this is a tax on the margin. So it's pulling some of the margin out of those companies and helping it fund the act.
My name is Tim from Comstock Park. So we were talking earlier about in the past, if you didn't have insurance, you go to the emergency room, that cost is spread amongst the people who are paying for health care. In 2014, you decide not to pay for health care, you pay the fine, you go to the emergency room. In theory, what happens?
You get health care.
Yeah, it's the same thing. This is the thing that's really interesting to me, is I've been covering more and more of these social issues. So kind of environmental issues for 12 years. I've been covering these social issues and political issues for the last 3.5 years. The one thing that I've realized is society is going to pay this price one way or the other. They're either going to pay it in bad health outcomes, or they're going to pay it in one cost or another. We're going to lose capital or human capital. So why not pay up front and do the best for your people, rather than pay at the end when we're trying to fix them up and they're not really useful to society anymore? It's just kind of a weird model, but it makes sense on certain planets, I suppose. I don't know.
Hi, I'm Tony from Nuevo, and it's my understanding that small employers with 50 or more employees are required to provide insurance for their employees, employers, I should say. And I specifically know of one company in Grand Rapids that has spent the last year splitting their company in two to make them two companies with less than 50 employees. Is there anything in the ACA to address this problem?
Well, first, it's 50 full-time employees. And I believe a little over 80% of all companies have fewer than 50 full-time employees, full-time equivalent. Also, there is no large employer mandate next year. That's been postponed to 2015. So anytime you hear in the press someone's hours has been reduced or they've been laid off because of the Affordable Care Act, there's no reason for anybody to be doing that. There's no large employer mandate next year. That's been postponed another year. So there's plenty of time for that company to weigh its options.
There's a lot going on. That is a short-term saving strategy. 49 full-time equivalent employees is the magic number to avoid the mandates. There's a lot of people who think that's worth doing, and so they'll have two 49-employee companies instead of one 100-employee company. Good luck, guys. Is that level of complexity going to save you money in the long run? They're running that experiment now.
You know, I saw a report recently on CNBC. I don't know if any of you watched that, but they were talking about how companies were spending so much money to avoid tax that and so much resources that they were actually hurting their company's bottom line and their ability to keep stock prices up because they were distracted not by the business of which they were in, they were distracted by finding so many different ways to find tax loopholes. That kind of reminds me of that. It seems short-sighted in the long run.
My name is Jeanette. I'm from Shalott. I have a 29-year-old son who does not have health insurance, and I've been trying to convince him to get some. And the gentleman over here that said, you go to the emergency room and get treated. And can I tell him that they'll come after your house or whatever if you're not paying?
You know, that's a really good point. Please understand, what's the number one cause of personal bankruptcy in the United States of America? So the answer is yes, they will come after him to try to collect, and there are health systems that do it brutally and viciously.
I would just point out, encourage him to go to the marketplace and take a look, maybe take him to it and show him. For example, 25-year-old in Detroit can buy a plan for $144 a month. That's before tax credits. I've seen examples of people who are paying only $30, $40, $50 a month once all the tax credits and subsidies are applied to their monthly premium. So for young adults, lower income categories, incredibly affordable plans on the marketplace once you apply all those subsidies.
I should say also, and I don't know if this applies to your son, but if you think that you may be part of the expanded Medicaid population or eligible for that, the Michigan Department of Community Health is saying go to healthcare.gov if you can get through and check to see if you are eligible for the Medicaid population, the expanded population, because I guess there's been over 5,000 people that have done that so far successfully, and you can actually see if you're eligible for that.
I'm Dave from Wayland. I'm piggybacking a little bit on what you said. I understand, might be wrong on this, that over 50% of personal bankruptcies are the result of a medical incident that they are not covered for. I guess I have two questions. First off, under the Affordable Care Act, is there a loss limit on a person's total exposure? And second off, how many of these bankruptcies have occurred where people actually have had insurance that has been less than adequate?
The majority of bankruptcies are amongst individuals who already have insurance. The majority of them are. Okay, these are people who buy healthcare plans that really don't cover anything. It's what they can afford, but what I would call a junk plan. When you need it, it's not there for you. It doesn't cover what your needs are. So the majority of the people forced into bankruptcy had insurance coverage at the time. And I forgot your second question.
Is there a loss limit?
Yeah.
Yes, there is. So for an individual, your out-of-pocket maximum is $6,300 approximately. Okay, so the expectation is anyone carrying an insurance card, it doesn't matter how bad the insurance is, your maximum out-of-pocket risk for that year is $6,300 as an individual. So, but again, as I said earlier, all plans going forward are going to be really good insurance plans. And we need to emphasize that. This isn't just about making insurance affordable. This is making insurance quality coverage. Every plan has maternity. Every plan has substance abuse. Every plan has free contraceptives. Every plan has free preventative care. And on and on and on. So the quality of all coverage across the board is going way up as of January 1 of this year.
Next question.
Hi, guys. Real quick, just three real quick things. First off, I've heard that, if you're in the individual market, you could have got a cancellation letter. Well, my wife just got hired into Meyer Corporate. She picked out her plan just a couple months ago, and we got a cancellation letter. She picked a plan that was below bronze, I guess. So we're employer covered, and we got a cancellation letter. Really quick, my second quick point is a big thing that Obamacare reduces, in my opinion, is something I call institutionalized fraud. Now, that's where a doctor's office, or hospital bills, $35 for MaxiPad, things like this. So for me, an easy, quick way to reference to how does the Affordable Care Act save us money? Well, it cuts down on institutionalized fraud. We have things now where, certain health providers are joining into groups where they're going to be not fee for service, but fee for healthy patients. So they're going to get paid on unhealthy patients. So which builds into my third point, which is just talking to the table earlier about, the ACA is an insurance reform. It's strictly insurance. Well, we know one thing that goes beyond insurance. Drug companies have been paying doctors and former doctors to push their drugs. Some of these doctors have been disbarred. Some of these doctors have lost their licenses. And that wasn't required disclosure before of the status quo. With the ACA, drug companies being outside the insurance system, they are required to report who they're paying for their doctors to go push drugs for them. So we do have the point that it's an insurance reform. But at the same time, if the panel has anything else, a little nuggets, in the law that are outside of insurance, like now drug companies have to tell us what doctors they're paying. I want to know that. A lot of people want to know that on the left and right. Who are these drug companies paying and so forth? So just real quick, I was in an employer and I got a letter. Number two, institutionalized fraud building into the outside of insurance reform. What does this bill do?
I want to know, what have you been reading? Because I would have liked to have seen some of those articles too. That's... I'm in a studio trying to write stories. I don't get to hear half of what you do. So, all right, let's look at his three points, starting with number one, employer insurance, also cancellations.
Okay. Sure, I'll tackle that one. So, it's true that again, all plans going forward have to have this basic level of benefits. It's a little bit more complicated as far as the timing when we're talking about large group plans versus the individual market. But the bottom line is the insurance companies are deciding for themselves right now if they want to continue particular lines of business. And if they don't want to continue those particular lines of business, they have a built-in excuse. They can just say it's because of the Affordable Care Act. Okay? And a lot of what's happening is just people blaming the Affordable Care Act. I mentioned large employers reducing people's hours, even though there's no large employer mandate, and saying it's because of the Affordable Care Act. We've been seeing this over and over and over again over the last 2-3 years where people are just citing the Affordable Care Act as a reason for doing certain things. So you just have to have a level of skepticism. And just kind of grin and bear it. We're going to get through this implementation stage in the next year or so. And I think ultimately we're going to be better off when we get through this.
Yeah. One point about that, if you have been seeing 15%, 25% increases in your cost to cover employees, boy, there's nothing like a good excuse to avoid that increased cost to your bottom line next year. So you can understand that. What was your number two point?
When you see a $10 aspirin on your hospital bill or a $35 MaxiPad, it sure looks like institutional fraud, doesn't it? But you know what? There's a thing called a charge master at a hospital. And a charge master, don't get me started, right? A charge master is a price list for everything the hospital uses for you as a patient and everything they do for you. There's a price for everything, okay? And the charge master is that price list. And it is totally irrational, okay? There's no rhyme or reason for why this thing is priced this way and that thing is priced that way. In your business, things are priced to the market generally in some relation to what they cost you. Not in hospitals. It does not work that way. So there's a lot of reasons for that. We don't have time to go into it. It sure looks like it's fraudulent, but let me tell you, you do not survive as a hospital chief financial officer if you haven't mastered the art of the charge master.
Yeah, there's a new business of consultants now who will go over your hospital bill and break it down and find out where you got gigged. And it's pretty amazing that we can create a whole new industry just to save you from being gouged by the hospitals. Number three was his point about pharmaceutical company influence on doctors and hospitals and so forth.
There are a lot of cool things in this act that you'll never hear about, and that's one. So thank you for pointing out that one. There are others, like the fact that if Medicare or Medicaid Medicare especially wanted to change how they paid hospitals and doctors, Congress had to approve it. Good luck with that, right? The way we pay hospitals and doctors incents them doing more for us, right? Because we pay them for every unit of care that they deliver to us. So if I pay you $100 for an office visit, your incentive is to deliver lots of visits, right? If I pay you $45 for a lab test, your incentive is to deliver a lot of lab tests, right? If it's $2,000 for an MRI, you want to run that MRI 24/7, right? And that's how we pay, and we're getting exactly what we're paying for. The people in healthcare are the smartest people I've ever worked with. They absolutely know how to maximize the incentives provided to them. You know what that's called? Being a good American, right? So they're just responding to the incentives that we provide them. CMS, under the Accountable Care Act, now has the ability to innovate with new payment methods and try to provide different kinds of incentives. So we're going to see lots of different experiments today being run out there, paying providers differently, including paying people to stay healthy.
All right.
Yeah, you know what, because we're recording this, if you have a question, get Steve's attention, and we'll catch you.
All right, Steve? We have a question from someone in the healthcare provider industry. Right?
I have to stand up. My name is Holly. I'm from Rockford. I'm thrilled to have NPR in my own backyard. I am a nurse. I work downtown at Butterworth Hospital. What I've been curious about is how this is going to affect the hospital. I can imagine, because I am intelligent and I can do math, that this will be good because the indigent care will be far less. But they're also nonprofits. So has there been any discussion about, any predictions about what this is going to do to the hospital?
You know, we were actually going to have somebody from the Michigan Health and Hospital Association here tonight, and we couldn't get that corrected. But I got to tell you, I haven't seen a lot of screaming and kicking from the MHA. In Lansing or anywhere else, because they're basically saying, let's see how it shakes out. There are some not-for-profit hospitals who are concerned that they might go out of business because of the ACA, but anybody want to speak to that?
Well, when the ACA was negotiated, the hospitals were at the table. They were well represented, and in fact, the hospitals supported the passage of the Affordable Care Act, ultimately, because you know they did the math and they signed off on some reductions as far as Medicare payments, that sort of thing, because they understood they would make it up on the back end. So as far as stakeholders go, the hospitals were well represented in that process, and they came to the conclusion, like the insurance industry, that this was a good deal.
We have heard some concerns. If you listen to Michigan Radio, you might have heard an NPR report that indicated some not-for-profit hospitals were really concerned about some unintended consequences of the ACA. And I wish I could remember the details, but, you know, I was probably trying to get kids to school and everything else. So,
just a couple of comments. A hospital is not a hospital. It's not a hospital. They're all very different. If you ask any of them, they're all going out of business and don't have enough money. That's just the way it works. What's the difference between a nonprofit hospital and a for-profit hospital? What's the legal difference? A nonprofit hospital cannot distribute profits to shareholders. That is the only difference. Okay? They find other things to do with their profits. Okay? They tend to pay themselves extremely well, for example. All right? That aside, they would say they earn it. And when you're in their hospital, you would probably agree with them. Right? Small rural hospitals are struggling in the state of Michigan. And there's some not so far from here, and there are people in this room who live in those communities where our smaller hospitals are at risk, right? There's no guarantee that they're going to be in existence 2 or 5 or 7 or 10 years from now.
Is there anything in the ACA that will help them or make things worse or speed their demise?
Well, just there is this thing called critical access status for a small hospital. You have to have 25 beds or less. If you get deemed to be a critical access hospital, you get better Medicare reimbursement, right? They basically pay you to keep your doors open because it's important for you to be where you are, right? So you have hospitals like Gerber Memorial in Fremont that has gone down to 25 beds to become a critical access hospital. Carson City today is trying to get down to 25 beds. You're going to see a deal between Carson City Hospital, Pine Rest, and Mary Freebed, probably on hospital beds to get them down. So those kinds of things, when you see them, those are nuggets in the back that are operating that you would never see if somebody didn't explain it to you.
Next question.
Yeah, I'm Jim from Rockford, and my wife is also a Spectrum nurse. If you talk to an OB-GYN doc, one of his major expenses is malpractice insurance. And in all the conversations on the Affordable Care Act, I've never heard one word about litigation or
tort reform.
Tort reform, which is one of the major factors of cost in this country, in my opinion.
Yeah, I just read recently that while that's cited a lot, it's actually not one of the major factors of cost. It's a lot less than is advertised. But at the same time, you know, malpractice insurance for a physician, for an individual physician, is quite expensive. It's not insignificant. Is there anything the ACA does to deal with that aspect of it, the fact that we're a litigious society?
We are, and the answer is a technical one, and it's simply that tort, the liability laws are state laws. They're a state-level issue, and the Accountable Care Act is a federal law. So the federal government doesn't have jurisdiction, basically, on those issues. They got to be handled. Jake's got to handle that for you in Lansing.
Yeah, Jake just did a story, or somebody at Michigan Radio just did, or Michigan Public Radio did a story about the fact that we're talking about removing the ability to sue pharmacies and things like that. I mean, there are people in Lansing who are looking at these kinds of issues.
It wasn't me. It was Pluta. So it was.
Oh, right. It wasn't as good as yours.
True. Exactly. when it comes to especially getting a lot of these issues done on the state level, I wanted to say that, for me, my knowledge really comes from what is coming up in the legislature here in Michigan. It was said that I was the smartest person in the room earlier. That might make me the dumbest person in the room, actually, when it comes to this. When it comes to hospitals lobbying for things that they want to get done, I think they've seen anytime you mention the word Obamacare or the ACA, it's such a politically toxic issue right now that No one wants to do that, especially coming up on an election year next year. So
they're just avoiding the topic and really not speaking out for or against or at all.
Yeah.
So tort reform in Michigan, I mean, it's talked about every once in a while. My conservative friends in the legislature bring it up occasionally. Are we going to see more of that? I know, you know, you start there. You start with the manufacturers, too. They'd love to see more tort reform as well. So,
you know, it's a complex issue. The issue of OBs is a particularly poignant one. Let's all agree right now there's somebody's always to blame for an ill child or a bad, what's known in the vernacular as a bad baby, right? These children go into neonatal intensive care. They stay for a very long time, and they cost millions of dollars, right? That's the somebody's to blame for that, right? That's how we as a society have decided to handle that. We've decided to handle that in the courts litigiously. We don't have a better vehicle for that. So until we change our minds about the way to deal with that, we're stuck with the system we've got, and it is very imperfect. I would certainly agree with that. Also understand that we kill or permanently maim or injure people in healthcare environments in this country at a rate of one fully loaded 747 nosing in every day.
Well, that's cherry. You're just full.
Okay. So I want to frame this issue of tort reform, right? The only, if that was happening in the airline business, how many of you would fly? No one? Really? Why do you set foot in a hospital? Right? So we've got that issue to deal with, and largely the only issue we have to deal with that is the courts as well. So what we need is a quality system installed throughout our healthcare system, our healthcare systems, all our healthcare environments, that minimize those issues, that drive the quality up, that drive the cost out, and make the care better for all of us, and tort issues will resolve themselves to a large extent.
I want Paul for Obamacare czar. Okay. Steve, way back there.
We're back in the bleachers.
So there's no personal bias to this question, I can assure you. Question I have is, with healthcare cost increases, what is your personal perception and just advice or thoughts around what's the real cost that our society has placed on healthcare with our decision to allow basically the Hippocratic Oath to drive costs? The idea of not being able as a society to make decisions about cost-benefit analysis, putting in pacemakers in people who are 80 years old, putting in saving certain people who are indigent and it's not personal bias. I'm just asking how, as a part of the increases, how much, because what happens is that drives the medical device and pharma companies, because that's in place, to be able to drive additional technological advances that in some ways are almost marginally beneficial.
Right. We get your point, and it's a fact that in the last 2 years of life, there's probably more healthcare dollars spent trying to prolong life than there was during the whole previous 88 years you were alive. So how do we make these judgments? Is putting in new titanium knee joint in a 90-year-old man a wise thing to do?
That depends on the 90-year-old man. The cogent statistic is 50% of Medicare costs are spent in the last 6 months of life. Right? Just understand that is a true statement. Right? So what drives that? Well, the first is we pay people to put those knee replacements in, and we pay them very well, and we don't care how old the person is, right? So because of the way we pay, we incent that behavior. So people just follow you follow financial incentives all day long, so does everybody else in healthcare. It's not their fault, right? They're responding to the incentives provided to them. Secondly, whose decision is it? Whose is it? It's yours. It's your decision. We have to be much more clear and much more strong in taking control of our own health care and what happens to us and being clear about what we want to happen to us. How many of you have a power of attorney for health care? Everybody look around, see how many hands are up. The rest of you look in the mirror. You are the problem on this issue.
Well, in regards to cost, I do trainings around the state, and one of the things I do is I explain our current healthcare system. Why are we doing this in the first place, right? Because a lot of people don't believe we should be doing it. Why are we doing it? And I put graphs up to show just how much healthcare is costing us in America and how astronomically more we pay than everyone else, both on the public side and the private side. It doesn't matter which side you look at. It's astronomically higher.
For worse results.
For worse results. And what I call it is the knucklehead tax. And we as a country, we pay this knucklehead tax, this hidden tax, for the fact that we've gone 100 years thinking that we don't need any kind of national healthcare strategy. We don't need to create leverage for consumers over providers and insurers like other countries have done many, many years ago. Virtually any other country, they're not paying a fraction of what we pay for pharmaceuticals, for example, because their government negotiates on behalf of their consumers. So a consumer in the United States may be paying $126 a month for a prescription, while a consumer in Australia for the exact same prescription is paying $6 a month. Okay? So we have failed to create leverage opportunities for consumers. That's the knucklehead tax that we've been all paying. And hopefully this is the beginning of a process where we're putting laws and leverage in place for consumers to try to get control of some of these costs.
All right. We are almost out of time. I have one more question. So we kind of compared, ACA, Affordable Care Act, to these previous big social programs like Social Security and Medicare. Social Security is going broke. Medicare is going broke. Yeah, well, point taken.
The actuaries say.
The actuaries, yeah, there we go again. So what's to say that we get off to a great start here? 5 years from now, everybody thinks the Obamacare was the greatest thing since sliced bread. We're all signing up for it, and the numbers don't work out, and they start getting shortchanged, or maybe we drop some of the subsidies because, you know, we've got to buy another carrier or something. What's the future? I mean, are we going to end up at, like, Social Security or Medicare or some of the other short-funded...
Well, I feel a lot rosier about Social Security than you do, apparently. But I think
I'm hoping.
I think Social Security is one of the great public policy successes in American history. But I will just say again, I think we need to just give this a little time. Again, the Congressional Budget Office has crunched the numbers. They say it's completely paid for. In fact, they say if you repeal the Affordable Care Act, you're adding $210 billion to the deficit in the first decade. So I think we move forward if we have to make adjustments going forward. As far
$210 billion in a decade. That's chicken feed. for our debt.
Still, it's still paid for, right? It's still paid for. Right, the law's paid for. So that's what everyone needs to keep in mind. We're not passing any debt onto our children, onto our grandchildren. And if we have to make adjustments going forward, we can certainly do that.
Any final points? Paul? Jake? Jake's out. I'm out.
I'd just like to say that I'm really, like you, really, really tired of spending endless hours on a worthless website. No, wait, that's Facebook. Never mind.
I want to thank you all. You've been a great crowd. I'm glad to see such a great turnout here. I mean, we have standing room only. The folks in the back, thank you for your patience and standing up all night. And I tell you what, this is my first visit to Rockford, Michigan, and it sure is pretty, and I like this brewery, and I think I'll be back for the beer. So, thanks.